Yes. Hey guys, my name is Gerald Peters, and I believe that anyone, regardless of age, race, or current financial situation, can build wealth and, if not, become financially free in 7 to 10 years. Welcome to the Money Flow Trading's podcast, Mastering the Trade, man. Hey, we're going to pick up where we left off. March 31st, I published a podcast entitled Tracking the Illuminati. We were digging into BlackRock, and we started by talking about Larry Fink, the CEO, legendary, a master of the universe, talking about Larry Fink, the CEO of none other than BlackRock. Yeah, that company. Today, I'm going to read his letter to you. I think it's awesome. I think you should read it. He puts out a letter every month. You might check it out. Let's get into it.
What can I bring for you on this glorious afternoon?
Well, Hector, here's the game plan. You're going to bring us 2 absolute martinis. You know how I like them, straight up. And then precisely 7.5 minutes after that, you're going to bring us 2 more. Then 2 more after that, every 5 minutes until one of us passes the fuck out.
Excellent strategy, sir.
I'm good with water for now, though. Thank you.
It's his first day on Wall Street. Give him time.
Time to rethink retirement. When my mom passed away in 2012, my dad started to decline quickly, and my brother and I had to go through my parents' bills and finances. Both my mom and dad had worked great jobs for over 50 years, but they were never in the top tax bracket. My mom taught English at a local state college, and my dad owned a shoe store. I don't know exactly how much money they made every year, but in today's dollars, it probably was not more than $150,000 as a couple. So my brother and I were surprised when we saw the size of our parents' retirement savings. Order of magnitude bigger than you'd expect for a couple making their modest income. And when we finished going over their estate, we learned why. My parents invested. My dad has always been an enthusiastic investor. It's probably why I do what I do. He encouraged me to buy my first stock, the DuPont Chemical Company, as a teenager. My dad invested because he knew that whatever money he put into the bond or stock markets would likely grow faster than it would in the bank. And he was right. I went back and I did the math. If my parents had invested $1,000 in 1960 and they put that money into the S&P 500, by the time they had reached retirement age in 1990, that $1,000 would be worth nearly $20,000. In other words, you 20x their money. That's more than double what they'd have earned if they just put that money in the bank. My dad passed away a few months after my mom in his late 80s, but both my parents could have lived well beyond the year 100 and lived comfortably. Why am I writing about my parents? Because going over their finances showed me something about my own career in finance. I had been working at BlackRock for almost 25 years by the time I lost my mom and dad, but the experience reminded me in a new and very personal way why my business partners and I founded BlackRock in the first place. And no, it wasn't to be evil and take over the universe like most people think. Obviously, we were very ambitious entrepreneurs, and we wanted to build a big and successful company, but we always wanted to help people retire like my parents did. That's why we started an asset manager, a company that helps people invest in the capital markets, because we believed participating in those markets was going to be crucial for people who wanted to retire comfortably and financially secure. We also believed the capital markets would become bigger and bigger part of the global economy. If more people could invest in the capital markets, it would create a virtuous economic cycle fueling growth for companies and countries, which would in turn generate wealth for millions of more people. My parents lived in their final years with dignity and financial freedom. Most people don't have that chance, but they can. The same kind of markets that helped my parents in their time can help others in our time. Indeed, I think the growth and prosperity generating power of the capital markets will remain a dominant economic trend through the rest of the 21st century.
Mr. Hanna, you're able to do drugs during the day and then still function, still do your job?
How the fuck else would you do this job? Cocaine and hookers, my friend.
Now, Mr. Fink opened up the beginning of this letter talking about his parents. And you're going to see why he does. And I may skip certain parts here, but I think the letter's really interesting. He does a very good job of explaining the banking system in America. A lot of people don't understand the banking system. They really don't understand mortgages. And they've taken a lot of this stuff for granted. Mortgages don't go back that long. The concept of a mortgage-backed security, that's our companies like AGNC, Anley Capital, or the ETF I've been buying shares in, or REM, or MORT. These are what they call an MBS, a mortgage-backed security. And securitizing mortgages is what helped cause, well, not a bad rating system, technically, is what caused the 2008 housing crisis. And you're going to see all this ties in. But let me read the last part he just said. My parents lived their final years with dignity and financial freedom. Most people don't have that chance. Truth is, they do. This is why I entitled my first book and my free ebook, You Do Not Have to Die Broke. How ordinary people can achieve extraordinary. And that is true. Everyone has time, everyone has an amount, and everyone can produce yield. The same kind of markets that help my parents in their time can help others in our time. Indeed, I think the growth and prosperity generating power of the capital markets will remain a dominant economic trend through the rest of the 21st century. For most of us, this is our only fucking hope. That's why it's so important. Now, Larry gets into a brief and admittedly incomplete history of the U.S. capital markets, but I think he does a very good job. Whew, I did a video a while back on the history of mortgages and securitization of mortgages. I wish I knew where that video is. I do so many. Last time I checked on YouTube, I had over 800 something videos. Last time I checked, at one point I had almost 1,000 podcasts. I don't know what's what. I just talk what's on my mind, what I'm doing, what I'm feeling. I try to document more than create. That's probably why my content isn't the most entertaining or the best, but it is the truth and it is or my truth. In finance, there are two basic ways to get and grow money. One is at the bank, which is what most people historically over time have relied on. They deposited their savings to earn interest or took out loans to buy a home and or expand their business. But over time, a second avenue for financing arose, particularly in the U.S. with the growth of the capital markets, publicly traded stocks, bonds, and other securities. A lot of young fucking haters out there, you socialists and all this bullshit on the left who don't like the markets or capitalism, and they can all go fuck themselves as far as I'm concerned, because capitalism has done more to pull people out of poverty than anything any fucking government or left-leaning person has ever done. Okay, same on the right. I'm not picking it. I just know that it tends to be on the left. They tend to really look down on capitalism. Well, those people are fucking poor. And if we let them run the country, we would all be fucking poor. But I got sidetracked. Let's finish. Let's get back on the letter. One is, we talked about that. But over time, second rap, which is finding particularly in the U.S., with the growth of the capital markets, publicly traded stocks, bonds, and securities. I saw this firsthand in the 1970s and early 1980s when I played a role in the creation of the securitization of market of mortgages. You know, this is some seriously cool shit. And this man was in on it, man. This guy was one of the creators of the modern day securitization of mortgages in the system of what we have today.
which is super cool, man. Before the 1970s, most people secured financing for their homes the same way they did in the Christmas classic, It's a Wonderful Life, through the building and loan, B&L. And I went and Googled this and looked it up and researched it. Pretty fascinating. You might do the same. Customers deposited their savings into the B&L, which was essentially a type of bank. Then that bank would turn around and lend out those savings in the form of mortgages, okay? In the movie and in real life, everything works fine until people line up at the bank, at the bank's front door, asking for their deposits back. As Jimmy Stewart explained in the film, the bank didn't have their money. It was tied up in somebody's house. After the Great Depression, B&Ls morphed into savings and loans, or what we refer to as S&Ls. And if you're around my age, you remember that was the first banking problem I remember. And the Clintons were all tied up in that. It was a big drama. Which had their own crisis in the 1980s. Approximately half of the outstanding home mortgages in the U.S. were held by S&Ls in 1980. And poor risk management and loose lending practices, sound familiar, led to a raft of failures costing U.S. taxpayers more than $100 billion, with a B. But the S&L crisis didn't cause the American economy lasting damage. Why? Because at the same time the S&Ls were collapsing, another method of financing was growing stronger. The capital markets were providing an avenue to channel capital back into the challenged real estate markets. This was mortgage securitization. Securitization allowed banks not just to make mortgages, but to sell them. In other words, they created a tradable product. By selling mortgages, banks could better manage risk on their balance sheet and have capital tied to lend to home buyers, which is why the S&L crisis didn't severely affect the American home ownership. Eventually, the excessive mortgage scrutinization contributed to the crash in 2008. And unlike the S&L crisis, the Great Depression did harm home ownership in the U.S. The country still hasn't fully recovered in that respect. But the broader underlying trend, the expansion of the capital markets, was still very helpful in the American economy.
More ripoffs. The savings and loan scandal could cost half $1 trillion. But in Washington, the big question still is, who gets the blame? Today, the president and his congressional critics gave a preview of the positions that they'll be taking to the voters later this year. More on that now from NBC's John Cochran.
Trying to deflect charges that he has pussyfooted on S&L fraud, President Bush told federal prosecutors from all over the country to intensify their efforts.
We will not rest until the cheats and the chiselers and the charlatans spend a large chunk of their lives behind the bars of a federal prison.
The cheats and the charlatans. In fact, it's worth considering, why did the U.S. rebound from the 2008 faster than almost any other developed nation? A big part of that answer is the country's capital markets. In Europe, where most assets were kept in banks, economies froze as banks were forced to shrink their balance sheets. Of course, the U.S. banks had to tighten capital standards and pull back from lending as well. But because the U.S. had a more robust secondary pool of money, in other words, the capital markets, the nation was able to recover much more quickly. Today, public equities and bonds provide over 70% of financing for non-financial corporations in the U.S., more than any other country in the world. In China, for example, bank-to-capital market ratios is almost flipped. Chinese companies rely on bank loans for 65% of their financing. In my opinion, this is the most important lesson in the recent economic histories. Countries aiming for prosperity don't just want strong banking systems. They also need strong capital markets. That is the lesson. That is the lesson now spreading around the world, replicating the success of America's capital markets. Last year, I spent a lot of days on the road, longing visits to over 17 countries. I met with clients and employees, and I also met with many policymakers and heads of state during those meetings. And most frequent conversation I had was about the capital markets. More and more countries recognize the power of American capital markets and want to build their own. Of course, many countries do have capital markets already. There is something like 80 stock exchanges around the world, everywhere from Kuala Lumpur to Johannesburg. But most of these are rather small with little investment. They're not as robust as the U.S. markets, and that's what other nations are increasingly looking for. In Saudi Arabia, for example, the government is interested in building a market for mortgage securitization, while in Japan and India, they want to give people a new place to put their savings. Today, in Japan, it's mostly the bank, and in India, it's often just gold.
I say I'm incredibly excited to be a part of your firm. I mean, the clients you have are absolutely...
Fuck the clients. Your only responsibility is to put meat on the table. You got a girlfriend?
I'm married. I have a wife. Her name's Teresa. She cuts hair.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Think about Teresa. Name of the game? Move the money from your client's pocket into your pocket.
Right.
When I visited India in November, I met with policymakers who laminated their fellow citizens' fondness for gold, a commodity. The commodity has underperformed the Indian stock market, proven a subpar investment for individual investors, nor has the investing in gold helped the country's economy. Compare investing in gold with, let's say, investing in a new house. When you buy a new home, that creates an economic multiplier effect. Because you need to furnish and repair the house. Maybe you have a family and you fill the house with children. All that generates economic activity. Even when someone puts their money in a bank, there's a multiplying effect because the bank can use that money to fund a mortgage. But gold, it just sits in a safe. It can be a good store of value, but gold does not generate economic growth. That's part of the reason governments fight against it. I would add that Bitcoin does create an economic effect. This is a small illustration, but a good one, of what countries want to accomplish with robust capital markets, or of what they can't accomplish without them. Despite the anti-capitalist strain in our modern politics, most world leaders see the obvious. There is no other force that can lift more people out of poverty or improve the quality of life quite like capitalism. No other economic model can help us achieve our highest hopes for financial freedom, whether we want it for ourselves and our country. Whether we want it for ourselves and our country. That is why capital markets will be the key to addressing two of mid-21st century's biggest economic challenges. The first is providing people what my parents built over time, a secure and well-defined retirement. This is much harder proposition than it was 30 years ago, and it will be much harder in the next 30 years from now. People are living longer, and they'll need more money. The capital markets can provide it, so long as governments and companies help people invest. Challenge number two, the second challenge is infrastructure, my friends. How are we going to build the massive amounts the world needs? As countries decarbonize and digitize their economies, they are supercharging demand for all sorts of infrastructure, from telecom networks to new ways of generating power. In fact, in my nearly 50 years in finance, I've never seen a more demand for energy. Infrastructure, that's more demand for energy infrastructure. And that's because many countries have twin aims. They want to transition to a lower carbon sources of power while also achieving energy security. The capital markets can help countries meet their energy goals, including decarbonization, in an affordable way.
But if you can make the clients money at the same time, it's advantageous to everyone, correct?
No. Number one rule of Wall Street. Nobody, I don't care if you're Warren Buffett or if you're Jimmy Buffett, nobody knows if a stock is going to go up, down, sideways, or in fucking circles. Least of all stockbrokers. Right? It's all a fugazi. You know what a fugazi is?
Fugazi. It's a fake.
Yeah, fugazi, fugazi. It's a wazi. It's a woozy.
Asking the old age question, how do we afford longer lives? Last year, Japan's demographic past a demographic milestone. The country's population has been aging since the early 1900s as the pool of working age people has shrunk and the number of elderly has risen. By 2023, for the first time, 10% of their people exceeded 80 years old, making Japan the oldest country in the world, according to the United Nations. That is part of the reason the Japanese government is making a push for retirement investment. Most Japanese keep the bulk of their retirement savings in banks, earning a low interest rate. It wasn't such a bad strategy when Japan was suffering from deflation, but now the country's economy has turned around, with the Nikkei surging past 40,000 for the first time in months this March. Most aspiring retirees are missing out on the upswing. The country didn't have anything resembling a 401k program until 2001. But even then, the amount of income people could contribute was quite low. So a decade ago, the government launched the Nippon Individual Savings Account, or the NISA, to encourage the people of Japan to invest even more in retirement. Now they're trying to double the NISA's enrollment. The goal is 34 million Japanese investors by the end of the decade. It will require the Japanese government to expand their capital markets, which historically has had very little retail participation. Japan isn't alone in helping more of its citizens invest for retirement. BlackRock has a joint venture called GIO BlackRock, or GIO, with the GIO Financial Services, an affiliate of India's Reliance Industries. Over the past 10 years, India has built a huge digital public infrastructure network that connects nearly 1 billion Indians to everything from healthcare to the government payment system via smartphones. Jio's BlackRock goal is to use the same infrastructure to deliver retirement investing and more. After all, India is aging too. The whole world is. I bet at different speeds. Brazil, we're starting to see more people leave the workforce than enter it by 2035. Mexico will reach peak workforce by 2040. India sometime around 2050. That's going to be a lot of fucking old people collecting money off the social welfare system. So these countries are going to be forced to create capital markets that allow their people to begin investing for their own selves. Well,
fairy dust. It doesn't exist. It's never landed. It is no matter. It's not on the elemental chart. It's not fucking real.
Right?
All right. Stay with me. Mm-hmm. We don't create shit. We don't build anything.
No.
So if you got a client who bought stock at 8 and it now sits at 16 and he's all fucking happy, he wants to cash in, liquidate, take his fucking money and run home, you don't let him do that. Because that would make it real.
Right.
Now, what do? You get another brilliant idea. A special idea. Another situation. Another stock.
And while Japan may be ranked as the oldest nation in the world, hey, fuck, the rest of us aren't very far behind it. Okay? Aging population, building retirement savings will have never been more urgent than it is right now. By the mid-century mark, 1 in 6 people globally will be over 65. Up from 1 in 11 in 2019. Damn. To support them, governments are going to have to prioritize building out robust capital markets just like the U.S. has. But this isn't to say the U.S. retirement system is perfect. I'm not sure anybody believes that the retirement system in America needs modernization at the very least. It's time to rethink retirement in the United States. This was particularly clear last year as the biotech industry pumped out a rush of new life-extending drugs. Obesity, for example, can take more than 10 years off someone's life. If we don't have any fat people, they're going to live longer, which is going to be a bigger strain on the system. So somebody's got to eat donuts. No, that's not what it means. That's why we're investing in Krispy Kreme, man. Obesity, for example, can take more than 10 years off someone's life expectancy, which is why some researchers think that new pharmaceutical drugs like, Ozempic? And why do they give them these names, man? These life-changing, extending drugs, not just weight loss, man. In fact, recent studies shows that All right, man. Somebody needs to get involved in the biotech industry. Make this shit simple. can give people with cardiovascular disease an extra 2 years of life where they don't suffer major conditions like a heart attack. In other words, we're all going to live fucking longer, okay? We focus a tremendous amount of energy on helping people live longer lives, but not even a fraction of that is spent helping people afford to live those extra years or how they're going to pay for them. Whew. These drugs are breakthroughs, but they underscore the frustrating irony. As a society, we focus a tremendous amount of energy on helping people live longer. People go to the fucking gym, but they don't invest. Huh? How about that? But not even a fraction of that is spent helping people afford those extra years. It wasn't always this way. One reason that my parents had financial secure retirement was CalPERS, California State Pension System. As a public university employee, my mom could enroll, but pension enrollment has been declining across the country since 1980, because while people live longer, they're fucking dumber. Meanwhile, the federal government has prioritized maintaining entitlement benefits for the poor. And for my age, I'm 71, even though it might mean that Social Security will struggle to meet its full obligation when younger workers retire. In other words, if you're smart and you work out and you live longer, you get to pay for the four people. That's what's going to happen, by the way. Don't misunderstand what's coming. It's no wonder the younger generations, millennials, Generation Z, are so economically anxious because they're fucking stupid. I added that part, by the way. They believe my generation, that's the baby boomers, have focused on their own financial well-being to the detriment of those who come after them because they like to blame other people for fucking everything. He didn't say that. I added that part. And in case of retirement, they might be right. Today in America, the retirement message that the government and companies tell their workers is effectively, you're on your own. No shit, Sherlock. You were on your own the fucking moment you were born. This, again, I added that. He didn't say that. And my generation fully disappears from the positions of before my generation fully disappears from the positions of corporate and political leadership, we have an obligation to change that. Highly doubt that happens, by the way. I added that. Maybe once a decade, the U.S. faces a problem so big and so urgent, the government and corporate leaders stop business as usual. They step out of their silos and they sit around the same table to find solutions. I participated in something like this after the 2008 crash in which the government needed to find a way to unwind toxic assets from the mortgage crisis because left-leaning motherfuckers gave everyone a loan. He didn't say that. I added that. More recently, tech CEOs and the federal government came together to address the fragility of America's semiconductor supply chain. We need to do something similar for the retirement crisis. America needs to get organized, high-level effort to ensure the future generations can live in their final years with dignity. What should that national effort do? I don't have the answers, but what I do have is some data at the beginning of a few ideas from BlackRock's work, because our core business is retirement. All right, man. Yes, yes, yes. Hey, thanks for making it to the end of the podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. I didn't want to bore it too long by continuously reading this long letter. We'll do part three in the next couple of days. Part three, tracking the Illuminati. I hope you enjoyed this. I encourage you to go read Larry Fink's letter. And in the third part, we're going to get into how we can use this letter to possibly do some trading and some investing using the information that BlackRock puts out for free. God bless. Hey, on the way out, recent house party with me and my buddy Anthony. We got two of our friends on guitar. My man named Stu. I've played his stuff. He's got albums on Spotify. And my good friend named Sam. They both play as professional guitarists. They both have bands here in New Orleans. This is just them sitting around the house. They never played together. One's on a banjo, one's on a guitar. And this is just them off the top of their head. And, you know, not the best recording. I did it with my phone. But you can see the kind of talent that I hang out with. I hope you enjoy it, man. Hey, maybe you come to New Orleans and party with me. I look forward to seeing you. God bless.